Good morning. This is lesson 22 in our study of Ezra and Esther. We'll be starting in a moment back in chapter 8 of Esther. Let me remind you that the audio copies of these lessons are all available still on the internet at studyezra.com, as well as any handouts we have. And today we do have a handout, so there's some in the back if you didn't get a chance to pick one up. There are a few still back there. We'll be referring to that later in our lesson today. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this, another beautiful day that you've given us, Father, a day to come and study your word and to worship you. We're thankful for this rain, Father, and we pray for those who are out in it and traveling that they will have safe travel, Father. And we're so thankful for this wonderful book of Esther you've given us and all that we can learn about you and about your love and about your plan for your people in that book, Father. We're thankful for your word and for the truth that we have, that we can read so readily and understand it. Father, in our prayers that we will always endeavor to live by what it says. And most of all, we're thankful for Jesus Christ, our Lord, our Savior, the Word made flesh. And we pray these things in his name. Amen. Well, we're nearing the end of our study of Esther. I'm on page 474 in my notes. And for those who think we're moving slowly, it could be a lot slower. Most of the time I spend each week is deleting stuff rather than adding stuff. I usually add stuff right at the beginning of the week, and then I spend the rest of the week deleting things. The whole process reminds me of a quote, a favorite quote of mine by Pascal. He wrote in one of his letters, he said, "I'm sorry I wrote you such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one." And of course, the point there is that editing is what really takes the time, and that's how I spend most of my time, is taking away stuff that I don't say. And the reason I point that out is that if any of you would like to take a deeper dive into this book, let me know, and I can recommend some very, very good commentaries on it that I have discovered during my research of this text. Now, last week we were near the very end of our study of chapter 8, verses 11 through 13. I just have a couple more things to say on those verses. And we ended by considering the king's edict written by Mordecai that the Jews were to kill both little ones and women. And we discussed the similarity between that edict and God's earlier command to King Saul in 1 Samuel 15, verse 3, that he was to slay both man and woman, infant and suckling. Now, the ancient enmity between the Jews and the Amalekites, we've seen it throughout the book of Esther. It's an underlying theme throughout the entire book. Every time Haman's plot is mentioned, we're told he's an Agagite from King Agag, the Amalekite. So we know that's underlying what's happening in this book. And, you know, we may look at that enmity, that ancient enmity, with disdain. Like, well, there they go again fighting a war that's centuries old. But doesn't the church have its own ancient enemies? Aren't we also surrounded by Agagites? The ancient Amalekites wanted nothing more than to wipe God's people off the face of the earth. And aren't there people today with exactly the same desire, and haven't they always been around? I mean, that's an ancient enmity. Haman the Agagite is with us still. He hasn't gone anywhere, and all you have to do is turn on your TV set to see him. He is seeking our destruction, and we have to fight back. Now, not with carnal weapons like we're going to see here in Esther, but with the sword of the Spirit, by remaining faithful and true to our leader, the head of the church, Ephesians 5:23. So we also have our ancient enemies. Now, the phrase "avenge themselves" in verse 13, that's significant. The Hebrew word used there for "avenge themselves," everywhere it's used, it designates a punitive action. It presupposes that some prior wrong had occurred. And they're avenging, they're responding to that prior wrong. That's what the word means. This decree is not giving the Jews carte blanche to go out and just kill anybody they don't like. And that's not how they're going to take it. And we're going to see that later when this decree starts going into effect. You know, why is that important to note here? The reason it's important is that later we're going to see Queen Esther ask for a second day of slaughter. And people have often wondered, well, you know, bloodthirsty Queen Esther, why is she asking for a second day of the slaughter? Keep in mind what they're doing here. They're avenging themselves from a prior wrong. They are responding to something. They are not just out trying to kill everybody that's ever had a bad thought about them. All right, let's pick up then in chapter 8, verse 14. So the post that rode upon mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment. And the decree was given at Shushan, the palace. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. First question, why the great urgency in verse 14 to get this second decree out? After all, the day of attack under Haman's first decree is still 9 months away. And according to Herodotus, it took only 3 months under the famous Persian postal system for a message to circulate throughout the entire empire. So that could have happened 3 times in the amount of time that's left until the first decree goes into effect. Why the great urgency that's mentioned here? Well, number of reasons. Most likely, it would take time for the Jews to assemble these armies. They'd been given permission to assemble armies. That's not going to happen overnight. They're going to have time to organize that and to do that. So it's important that they get started. Plus, I think it was just important for all the Jews to know their situation was no longer hopeless, right? I mean, they had seen the first edict, and they probably thought there's no hope left. So it's important to let them know that. Some of them may have been preparing to flee. In fact, some of them may have been preparing to head to Jerusalem, where the exiles presently are at this time. But they needed to know that the tables had turned, and they needed to know that quickly. But I think there's another reason for the urgency here. Each detail that we're seeing in this decree shows how Mordecai in his decree does not merely parallel Haman in the first decree, but in fact Mordecai does him one better. Every time it comes to Mordecai, Mordecai is a little better than Haman. It's just a little better each time, and we see that here. Xerxes gives Haman the signet ring only when it's time for Haman to do what he needs to do with it. But with Mordecai, Mordecai got the signet ring right from the start. Haman's decree goes forth by couriers, chapter 3, verse 13. Mordecai's decree goes forth by couriers mounted on special royal steeds. Haman's decree goes out in haste, chapter 3, verse 15. Mordecai's decree goes out in urgent haste, even faster. Mordecai is triumphing over Haman in every possible way. Every detail shows that Mordecai is doing better than Haman was doing. Now, Mordecai is greatly honored by the king. And the Jews rejoice everywhere when the second edict is announced. And you know how worried they must have been with the first edict. And you can imagine their relief when the second one is read to them. And they must have wondered, well, what has caused this? I mean, what has caused this to happen? What has been going on in the background that we're not aware of that have caused the king to issue a second decree? They must have wondered about that. And they may have thought that the second decree meant no one was going to try to do them any harm. But if that's what they thought, they were going to be disappointed on that. There was going to be a battle here. We'll see it in a moment. Now, the crown in verse 15, that's really a turban. The word for turban, and along with all the other clothes that are mentioned there, it shows how Mordecai's position in the government has become so important. That's all clothing that shows how important Mordecai was. And we know he had taken over for Haman, which means we know he's now second in command. And again, the text is making the point that the honor Mordecai received here is far beyond anything Haman had ever received. We haven't seen this description of Haman before. Now, the parallel structure of Esther is really on display here. Really on display. The original decree had caused great mourning among the Jews. The second decree causes great rejoicing among the Jews. After the original decree, Mordecai was clothed in sackcloth and could not come before the king. With the second decree, Mordecai wears royal garments and he comes right in front of the king, before the presence of the king. Everything is being reversed and we have a parallel to everything that had happened before. As with most changes of clothing in Esther, Mordecai's new clothes illustrate his new status. As we noted earlier, change in clothing typically indicates a change in status in the book of Esther, and we see that right here. Now, Xerxes' earlier command in chapter 6, verse 11, remember that one? He told Haman to clothe Mordecai in Xerxes' own robe and then parade him throughout the city. I mean, now that's looking almost prophetic because, in fact, Mordecai now is wearing that robe all the time. That event in chapter 6 foreshadowed what we're now seeing in the life of Mordecai. And remember when Mordecai had first heard Haman's decree, as I mentioned, he had taken off his garments and clothed himself with sackcloth, chapter 4, verse 1. When he was dressed that way, he could not even enter into the king's gate, chapter 4, verse 2. Now, with the second decree, Mordecai is clothed in splendor, and he can come right before the presence of the king. I mean, if you're ever looking for a book for some sermon content or for some devotional ideas, Esther's the book. There's just lessons on every verse. Now, the four words in verse 16, light, gladness, joy, honor, those are the antithesis of the four words we saw in chapter 4, verse 3, mourning, fasting, weeping, wailing. That has been turned to light and gladness and joy and honor. What is that? That's a great reversal. God's people have experienced a huge, dramatic reversal. And in keeping with one of the main themes of the book, what's going to happen next? Verse 17, a feast. You have a feast. And so right there we see both of the main themes, reversal and feasting. Now verse 17 has a really interesting detail that the commentaries just go all over the place on, and that is that many of the Persians declared themselves Jews, or became Jews, as some of the translations have it. The Hebrew word used there occurs nowhere else in the Bible, and of course that means its meaning is widely debated. It appears to be a Hebrew equivalent of a verb that meant to Hellenize, that is to act like a Greek, except here, of course, it's acting like a Jew, but that's where the word came from. And to Hellenize could have meant just to speak Greek, or it could have meant something much deeper, to adopt Greek customs and to adopt Greek values. It was an ambiguous term, and the same ambiguity applies here. We're not exactly sure what it meant to become Jews. Now, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, as it sometimes does, it kind of adds in some details that are not in the inspired text. And the Septuagint adds the detail that they became Jews and were circumcised. If true, that would seem to answer the question of their sincerity, but that's not in the text. Well, what does it mean that they became Jews? Well, first, we've seen this before throughout the Bible. God's promise to Abraham had been a promise to bless the entire world. The entire world. Not just the Jews, but the entire world. And other Gentiles had declared themselves Jewish prior to this time. In fact, we can see that elsewhere in the Old Testament. We can see that when we look carefully at the genealogical lists, because we can look at the names in those lists and see that some of them were most likely Gentiles who had become proselytes and become part of the Jewish religion. So the question is not, you know, had it ever happened before? The real question is, why did it happen here? Why did it happen here? Well, most likely these Persians had seen these dramatic reversals, and they most likely recognized that these events had to have come from some type of divine source. That's the very fact that the reader has been invited to see over and over and over again, and I think they were seeing it. They were understanding that. Perhaps, as one commentary described it, these Persians had simply had a public perception of divine involvement and were reacting to that. You know, Romans 1, verse 20 says that everybody on this planet should be having a public perception of divine involvement when they look at the beauties of creation, because the wonderful creation of God should cause everybody to understand that there is a God and that God is powerful. That Romans 1:20 says everybody should be reacting that way. So perhaps the Persians were reacting that way to what they had seen in this dramatic reversal. The Persians certainly knew at least two things. They had a first edict from Haman, who was now dead. And they had a second edict from Mordecai, who was very much alive and very powerful. The Jews were on top, and this may have caused many of the Persians to also want to be on top, to join in with them when they were on top. And of course, these same Persians would be the first people to jump ship as soon as the Jews were no longer on top. I think that's most likely what's going on here. Esther had earlier risked death to identify herself with the Jews. I think these Persians are just looking for some personal gain to identify themselves with the Jews. In fact, when we study the book of Revelation, we see some similarly motivated conversions, in quotes, from those who were watching what was going on. Now, the later rabbis, when they got to this point, they compared these Persians to what they called the lion proselytes. The lion proselytes. And the lion proselytes were the proselytes of Samaria who adopted the Jewish faith because of their fear of the lions that God had sent to punish the idolaters in the land. That's in 2 Kings 17:24 through 28. So the rabbis called them the lion proselytes. They had only joined up because they didn't want to get eaten by a lion. And of course, when the rabbis said that, it was not a compliment. Now, another reason for their conversion is that perhaps they had seen in Esther and in Mordecai a faith and a trust in one God. We don't know that because God's not mentioned here, and we don't see Esther and Mordecai praying, etc., but that's a possibility. And if so, that faith in one God would have stood in such stark contrast to the vanity of their own polytheism that was present in Persia. Of course, we see the same thing again in the New Testament as the pagans were drawn to the power of the gospel. Power of the gospel. Pagan religions have nothing but disillusionment and disappointment. That was true then. That's true today. You know, I sometimes fear that we think paganism is just a thing of the past. An ancient false religion that's not a problem in our modern sophisticated world. Nothing could be further from the truth. Satan would love for us to believe that paganism is dead. But paganism is alive and well. And again, all you have to do is turn on the TV to see it in action. Men worship nature today more than they ever did in the past. Men worship more false gods today than they ever did in the past. Paganism has gone nowhere. And again, we need to make sure we're shining the light of the gospel into that pagan world, and it surrounds us. Now, while the nature of the conversion, sincere or not or whatever, that's a little uncertain, its significance is clear in the book of Esther because it represents another reversal. It's another example of a reversal. Earlier in these events, as I mentioned, Esther had to conceal her own Jewishness, most likely out of fear. Now it's the Gentiles who are afraid, and they're trying to hide their non-Jewishness. It's a complete and total reversal. What is the fear in verse 17? Is it fear of God? Well, we're not told. The Hebrew word used there means a nearly debilitating fear, one that induces trembling. It's often used for the fear of God, as in Isaiah 2:10 and in 2 Chronicles 17:10. But sometimes it's used for the fear of other things, such as the fear of military might in Deuteronomy 2:25 and 11:25. So we can't tell just from the word whether it's fear of God. Perhaps they simply have feared the Jewish attack that could now come against them. But again, that attack was not directed at all Persians. That attack was directed at those Persians who were trying to kill the Jews. Another view is that the Persians themselves had noted these huge reversals that had occurred and were still occurring, and that they now understood who was behind those reversals, or that some divine power was behind those reversals, and they now feared that divine power. If that's true, then maybe verse 17 is the clearest reference to God in a book that does not mention God. Perhaps that is the fear of God. Maybe that the Persians were afraid not just of the Jews, but of the power behind the Jews that they now perceived. Now, we know Haman was an Amalekite. And, of course, we can assume his sons were also Amalekite. But we don't know if anybody else was an Amalekite here. For those Amalekites who remained, though, and there likely were a few that remained, at least, this fear of God was a big reversal for them, for the Amalekites. Remember how the Amalekites were described in Deuteronomy 25, 17 and 18? Deuteronomy 25, 17 and 18. Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you were come forth out of Egypt. How he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee when thou wert faint and weary. And he feared not God. That's describing the Amalekites. Not only were they kind of cowardly, lurking in the background and trying to knock off the weak people that were in the back of the troop. But they feared not God, is what Deuteronomy tells us. Well, these descendants of Amalek, including Haman, who's now gone, and his 10 sons, they had experienced a complete reversal. They were understanding the fear of God that was lacking in Deuteronomy about the Amalekites. Questions about chapter 8. Chapter 9, verse 1. Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them, the Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. Well, the day for the attack has finally come. The month of Adar would correspond to February or March, likely in the year around 473 BC. If that is the year, then Xerxes himself will be killed in about 8 years, assassinated. Haman had cast his lot almost a year ago to determine the month and the day. And now Haman is gone, but Haman's edict remains. But that edict is not alone anymore. There's another edict, a second edict, that's given the Jews permission to defend themselves. So that's now the setting when the day has finally arrived. Things have not gone as Haman has assumed they would go, but his edict still is in effect. Now you should circle in your Bible a key phrase in verse 1. It was turned to the contrary, or the reverse occurred, or one translation has the tables were turned. There, in a nutshell, is the theme of the entire book of Esther. The Hebrew word is emphatic, and denotes a complete turnaround of fortunes, like when a curse becomes a blessing, or a blessing becomes a curse, a complete turnaround. The Hebrew word can literally mean to flip over. God's people were on the bottom, now they're on the top. Some of the other verses where you see it are 2 Kings 21:13, and I will stretch over Jerusalem the line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. I will wipe Jerusalem as a man wipeth a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. That's the word. Hosea 7 verse 8, Ephraim, he hath mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. That's the word. The same Hebrew root word is found in Deuteronomy 32 verse 20. You might make a note of that verse also in the margin somewhere here. Deuteronomy 32, verse 20. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be. For they are a very froward, twisted, that's the word, generation, children in whom is no faith. A twisted generation. I will hide my face from them. Why is that reference significant? It may be that the entire theme of reversal in the book of Esther is pointing back to that verse, Deuteronomy 32, verse 20. God's people had reversed themselves away from God, which was why they were now in exile. They were on the right path, but they had turned off of it. They had reversed course and had turned back on the right path, going the opposite way. The book of Esther shows, though, that God is the master of reversals. God is the master of reversals, and God could use reversals to bless his people even while they were suffering as exiles. It reminds us once again of Joseph. Remember what Joseph told his brothers in Genesis 50, verse 20, after their father died and the brothers were afraid that Joseph would now kill them? And Joseph says, as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring unto pass this day to save many people alive. That's a reversal, a huge, complete reversal by God. And I think that this is reminding us of that. But how is Deuteronomy 32, verse 20 connected with the book of Esther? What's the key that makes that verse so important? Well, how does Deuteronomy 32, verse 20 describe God? I will hide my face from them. Where is God in the book of Esther? He is never named in this book. In a sense, God is hiding his face in the book of Esther. God's people had turned away from God. God had hidden his face from them. But even then, he loved them and was working on their behalf. Even then. It reminds me of the father of the prodigal son. The prodigal is off in wild living. And what's the father doing? Watching, waiting. So as soon as that son comes on that road, the father sees him immediately and runs to meet him. That's the God we see on every page, in every line of the book of Esther. Now, verse 1 says that the enemies of the Jews hope to have power over them. You know, I keep mentioning all the themes in the book of Esther, and there are a lot of them. The main ones that we know are feasting and reversal. But, you know, to understand any book in the Bible, you can't just atomize it into verses. You have to stand back and look at the themes and understand why it's all put together the way it is. And another theme we've seen in this book is the ability or the inability to exert power over someone. We've seen it all throughout the book. The ability or the inability to exert power over someone. Xerxes could not get Vashti to appear before him. Haman could not get Mordecai to bow down. Esther could get the king and Haman to come to her feast. Esther could get the king to execute Haman. Esther could not get the king to overturn the first edict. Esther could get the king to issue a second edict. Over and over, the power comes and the power goes. The power comes and the power goes. The question we're left with is, who is the ultimate power? Who has the ultimate power here? And one thing we're absolutely certain of, it is not King Xerxes. In fact, a child of God reading this book knows who has the ultimate power here. But that's a theme we see throughout the book. The end of verse 1 says the Jews had rule, had power over those that hated them. That's an example of this. The tides have changed. They had power over the Jews, now the Jews have power over them. And in fact, it says the Jews had rule over them that hated them. Here, hater, is a synonym for enemy. We see a similar usage in Deuteronomy 30, verse 7. And the Lord thy God will put all these curses upon thine enemies and on them that hate thee. That's what we have here, the enemies, those that hated the Jews. It's more than just an emotion. It's more than that. These haters were actively seeking to harm the Jews. They were acting on that emotion of hatred. And again, this is most likely that same racial hatred that we'd seen before between the Amalekites and the Jews. Now, verse 2 makes it clear again that the Jews destroyed only those who sought to destroy them. That means they sought to destroy only those who were physically attacking them, and not merely those who wished them harm. The Jews' intention was not simply to go on a murderous rampage. They were trying to stop the attackers. Verse 2 also shows that the Jews, like Esther, had themselves undergone a transformation. No one could stand against them because of the fear of them that had fallen on all the peoples. We're seeing a different body of Jews, aren't we, than we had seen earlier in this book. These Jews, I think, must have also seen the hand of God at operation here. And what had that done to them? That had emboldened them. That had encouraged them. If we're ever timid, despite what 2 Timothy 1:7 says, if we're ever timid or lack courage, then we also need to look to see the hand of God at work. And then that will embolden us and encourage us, just as it seems to have done here with the Jews. Verse 3. And all the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and officers of the king helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. Verse 3 tells us that the Persian officials helped the Jews because they feared Mordecai, who was becoming more and more powerful. And unlike with Haman, these Persians apparently did not need an order from the king to give honor to Mordecai. They did it all on their own. It's amazing both then and now how fast the political winds can change. And then as now, power draws politicians like a moth to a flame. These same officials no doubt had been Haman's greatest admirers, and now they seem to be founding members of the Mordecai fan club. But if Mordecai were to fall, they would again would switch to someone else. The verb here translated helped, it means to lift, to bear, to carry. Same verb we saw in Esther 3 verse 1 about the promotion of Haman. Promotion of Haman, and once again we see a reversal. Previously it was Haman who was lifted up, now it's the Jews. Verse 4 tells us this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. There may be an allusion there to another great deliverer of God's people, Moses. Exodus 11 verse 3. And the Lord gave people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, in the sight of the people. Sounds a lot like what we just read about Mordecai. If in fact that is a reference back to Moses, why is that important? Because Exodus 11, where that's taken from, that's where the Passover appears. And in fact, Purim is going to be another feast instituted here in the book of Esther that may be linking Purim with the Passover as Moses is linked with Mordecai. Verse 5. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction and did what they would unto those that hated them. And in Shushan the palace the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. And Parshandatha and Dalphon and Asphatha and Paratha and Adalia and Aradatha and Parmashta and Ariasa and Ariada and Vajithsada, the 10 sons of Haman, the sons of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews, slew they. But on the spoil laid they not their hand. On that day the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. The words in verse 5, slaughter, destruction, those parallel the words in the two decrees. They had been given permission to do that. Both decrees had given permission to do that. Verse 5 also tells us the Jews did what they would unto those that hated them. Another translation is they did as they pleased unto those that hated them. That phrase is important because it really highlights the reversal that's taken place here between the outcome that was occurring and the outcome that Haman had planned to occur. Haman had been told by the king what in chapter 3 verse 11. King had said to Haman, you can do as you please. You can do as you please to this troublesome people who you haven't even named in chapter 3. That's what the king told Haman. Here it's the Jews who could do as they please and were doing as they pleased to the Persians who attacked them. Nehemiah 9:24 uses the same phrase. So the children went in and possessed the land, and thou subduest before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and gavest them into their hands with their kings and the people of the land, that they might do with them as they would. That's the same phrase. Why is that important? Because that's pointing back to the conquest of the Canaanites. The conquest of the Canaanites. The Amalekites were Canaanites. The Gibeonites, the Amalekites, those were all Canaanites. And the parallels are significant here because, as we know, that's the underlying thing that's happening throughout the book, is the fight between the Amalekites and the Jews. So, in fact, Nehemiah later uses the exact same phrase to describe what happened back when the Amalekites were first supposed to be conquered. And now the same phrase is being said of the Jews with the descendants of those Amalekites. The placing of the phrase in Susa, the palace, at the beginning of verse 6, the fact that it's at the beginning of that sentence emphasizes it. It means it's important, unusually important in the text. Why? Because it was an unusual circumstance for 500 people, or however many, we're going to see 500 there and others elsewhere, to be killed in Susa, the palace. That's where the king was. It'd be like saying 500 people were killed, you know, right outside the White House. That would be big, big news. And in fact, that's why it's being emphasized here. It was in Susa, the palace, that these 500 people were killed. Now, that 500 were killed there, I think, tells us that most Persians were not joining in on this fight. 500 seems like a lot, but it's not a very large percentage of the population. And later we're going to see 75,000 people killed elsewhere. Now, these 500, maybe they were being led by the 10 sons of Haman, who were named in verses 7 through 9, and who verses I'm not going to read again. Verses 7 through 9, they were also killed by the Jews. Now, a lot of commentaries going, why were Haman's sons killed? I think it's pretty clear why Haman's sons were killed, right? I mean, just from a purely prudent political action, I mean, that's the first reason. it was to prevent Haman's descendants from wreaking revenge upon the Jews. You think, well, would that have happened? Well, yes, that's happening because that's what Haman was doing, right? Haman was wreaking vengeance on the Jews from something that happened centuries ago. And we don't think Haman's sons would do it for something that happened yesterday? So yeah, it was a very prudent political move to get rid of Haman's sons. It also demonstrated Haman's total and complete defeat. In Esther 5, verse 11, Haman had bragged to his wife and his friends about his riches, about his sons, and about the way he'd been promoted. Each of those sources of pride has now been stripped away from Haman and given over to the Jews. His riches were given to Esther in chapter 8, verse 1. His promotions were given to Mordecai in chapter 8, verse 2. And now his sons, too, have fallen into the hands of the Jews. With the death of his sons, Haman's downfall is complete and it is total. Now, the names of Haman's sons, which are on the handout, have been cited frequently as evidence of this book's authenticity and the early date for the book's authorship. Why? Well, in ancient times, it was a very common practice to name your children after a deity and to incorporate the name of a deity into your child's name. Haman's sons, the names that are listed there on the handout and in chapter 9, those names include the names of various Persian deities. Well, how does that help us date the book? Because at this time, there was a huge religious change going on within Persia. And there was a change from the gods of the old Persia into Zoroastrianism. And that was going to be a complete and total reversal, in a sense, not a reversal that's discussed in Esther, but their own reversal of the religion of Persia. And by the time that Xerxes' son is in power, that's Artaxerxes, who, by the way, is the king when Ezra and Nehemiah come back. But by the time he's in power, Zoroastrianism has really taken hold. And under Zoroastrianism, those former Persian deities are now considered demons, which means you'd never name your child after that. So in fact, the fact that we see those Persian deities in these names tells us this book is not only authentic, but it was written at an earlier time, and whoever wrote this obviously was using the actual historical facts. I mean, we know that because we know the book is inspired. But if you're ever trying to convince someone else of that, this is a good place to go, Esther 9, and look at the names there. Now, there's something else interesting about those names. In the earliest Hebrew text, the sons of Haman are always listed in two columns. And in fact, you can see that on your handout here. These are the Haman's sons' names here, and then this is kind of the word preceding it. But you can see how they're listed and they're set apart in kind of a column format. The thing on the right here is from the Leningrad Codex, which was around 1000, AD 1000. It's the oldest complete Hebrew Bible that we have. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, it gave us manuscripts that were 1,000 years earlier than the oldest one that we had before they were discovered, which was the Leningrad Codex. This is just some other Esther scroll, not a famous one, but it shows how the scroll would have looked and how the names are completely set apart in huge font and set apart differently. And all of the Hebrew manuscripts that we have do that. So the question is, why? Why is that done that way? And the rabbis and the commentators have speculated about it ever since. Some suggest it's showing how they were hanged on the gallows, maybe even the order in which they were hanged on the gallows. That's a possibility. I think the one I like the best is that it shows how God's enemies had been set apart for destruction, that they were set apart for destruction. And that may also be why that kind of unusual arrangement is shown there. There's one other place in the Bible where that also occurs in the Hebrew manuscripts, and that's in Joshua 12, where there's a list of conquered Canaanite kings, And every time we see that in the Hebrew manuscripts, they're also written in a different column type format, which is similar to what we see here. One commentary said, "It is as if the author wants the reader to ponder each name, for with each death comes the final blow to Haman's pride." When the Esther scroll is read at the Feast of Purim, and that's what would happen at the Feast of Purim, they will take a scroll just like this one and read the whole thing at the Feast of Purim. And when that happens, those names are recited in a single breath. In a single breath, they're read out without any breath in between to illustrate the contempt in which Haman and his lineage were held among the Jews. Now, the text unexpectedly tells us three times that the Jews did not lay their hands on any plunder. And I say unexpected because the edict specifically gave them permission to take plunder, and the edict had been written by Mordecai. So it's kind of odd that three times we're told they were given permission, but they did not do it. It must have been very important for us to know that they did not take plunder because it's repeated. Why is it important? Well, it was important for the Persians to know that the Jews were simply defending themselves. They weren't like Haman. They weren't out for material gain. They were just defending themselves. That would have shown that they were certainly distinctive, because that was not something you would expect from pagan peoples of the time. Usually at any time at this point in history, if the pagans came in and conquered somebody, they would take all the spoils and run away with it. The Jews did not do that here. So it certainly showed they were distinctive, and I think it also demonstrated to the Persians their motivation. I think second, in not taking the plunder, the Jews were fulfilling the command to King Saul regarding the Amalekites. I think that's also something that's here. Now, the only Amalekites we know about here are Haman and his 10 sons, but there were likely some others. Unlike Saul, these Jews would not disobey the command for taking plunder. You can also read about Achan in Joshua 7 and how he brought destruction upon the people by keeping plunder. The Jews were learning from their past mistakes, I think is the message here. The Jews of Persia were obeying where King Saul had disobeyed. Given that, though, it's again kind of an odd thing that Mordecai had put that in there in the first place. You know, maybe Mordecai had put it in there so that he would then know they wouldn't do it, so it would be very clear they had permission and then they didn't do it, and that may be the best explanation. But again, it causes us to wonder a little bit about Mordecai and what Mordecai's motivations were. Was Mordecai motivated by his desire to obey where Saul had disobeyed? We're not told. Now, I mentioned earlier that Haman and his sons are the only Agagites, the only Amalekites that we know about here. Jewish tradition, once again, fills in the gap. And according to Jewish tradition, about everybody in Persia was an Amalekite. I mean, I think everybody but Esther and Mordecai, they have everybody being an Amalekite. I think that's a little overkill. I think there probably were some other Amalekites there, but certainly I don't think most of them were Amalekites. Now, there's something that's not here, that's not in the text here, that a little worrisome. It goes back to something we talked about last week. Last week we talked about the fact they were given permission to kill women and children. And we spent 15, 20 minutes talking about that last week. Now, they were also given permission to take the plunder, right? And we're specifically told here they did not take any plunder. Three times. No plunder, no plunder, no plunder. Where are we told here they did not kill women and children? We're not. It's not here. We're not told that. Mordecai's edict gave them the right to do so, and there's nothing here about them not doing it. Should we assume then that they did in fact kill the women and the children? In fact, were some of Haman's 10 sons still children? At this time, we're given no indication Haman was an old man, and most Persians in this time would continue to father children as long as they were able to do so. So unfortunately, or fortunately, however you look at it, it's actually quite likely that some of Haman's 10 sons were quite young. And we're not told here that they did not kill the women and children. And again, you might go back and, if you weren't here last week, listen to that all that we said about that last week, because there's a lot in the background on that question as to whether they killed the women and the children. But the silence on that issue here is perhaps a bit telling. Verse 12. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. Or what is thy request further? And it shall be done. Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. And the king commanded it so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's ten sons. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day of the month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hand. What is the king thinking in verse 12? Is he worried that so many have been killed so close to his home? Is he upset by it? Is he unconcerned? Is he concerned? Is he angry? Is he astonished? Does he admire the Jews? Well, we don't know. The king informs Esther about the 500 deaths in Susa and the deaths of Haman's 10 sons, and he wonders what must have taken place in the other provinces. He also asks Esther what she wants now. What do you want now? Now, one thing you'll note that's missing there is that half-kingdom offer. I think the king is through giving out half-kingdom offers. So he just says, what do you want now? Some suggest the king's question should be read, surely in light of what you have achieved, you can't want anything more. Yeah, but she does. She does want some more. And we'll start next week by looking at that. I think we'll probably finish up the book of Esther next week. And when we get through with Esther, we'll move right back into Ezra chapter 7. Thank you very much for your attention.